Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6. The Prime Minister insists new grammars in England can help ensure every child gets into a good school. But not everyone agrees, as Barry Weir reports.
But Theresa May says it's not fair that currently, if you can afford a house close to a good school, then your child gets a place. But Labour's Jeremy Corbyn doesn't think grammars work.
It is dividing children on the basis of their perceived ability at the age of 11.
Did you know in the last days God's got plans for the Jews and the Arabs, and they will live in peace in the land? Right from Iraq through to the Nile River, from the Euphrates to the Nile, the Arabs and the Jews will all live together, for God has ordained that that will be the case. I wish I had time tonight to share this with you from the book of Isaiah. Jesus will settle the problem in that land.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Years after 9/11, who made money betting insurance and airlines shares? And why aren't they in jail? On the road to Damascus, a big conference in London of the so-called Syria opposition. But they say Assad has got to go, just as it's looking like he may win. Only to find NATO in the form of Turks occupying the north of his country. Also, Menwith Hill, a square mile of America in the wilds of the North Yorkshire Moors. Snowden revelations have proved that a programme called Ghost Hunter has been doing the targeting for the drone strikes from Menwith Hill. So why have none of the London media covered this most important revelation this week from The Intercept? And also the 15th anniversary in 2 days' time of the 9/11 attacks. We hear from Manfred Petrisch, who is a regular visitor to New York's World Trade Center, as well as Christopher Bolin. He looks at the foreknowledge, evidence that many people were warned not to go to work that day by a man who we featured on this show, coincidentally, last week as someone who was possibly complicit in the 7/7 London bombings, too. I'm talking about a chap called Kobe Alexander. He's just been taken back to the United States by the Security and Exchange Commission. He stole $33 million from his technical company. He's an Israeli. And his instant messaging service that warned some people before the 9/11 attacks was called Odigo. More on the 9/11 attacks on our sister show Dialect, which is back at noon every Tuesday. So, Martin, we start by looking at this anniversary of 15 years since the 9/11 attacks. Now, you're part of some group called Reinvestigate 9/11. What first put you onto that? How quickly after those attacks did you start to realise something was wrong?
Well, immediately I realised that the people who were blamed for the attack, the Osama bin Laden organisation, had been created by the CIA back in the day. So there was obviously a big, you know, lacuna in people's understanding of what had happened anyway. I actually went to tackle a chap from the US Embassy, a guy called Mort Dworkin III, political attaché at the US Embassy, at a seminar at the LSE about US power.
And so how long after the attacks was that?
That was about two weeks, three weeks after the attack. So I was already suspicious.
So who is,
and I'd already picked up on the fact that John O'Neill...
Who is this guy, Mort Dwork?
Well, he was a political attaché at the US Embassy. But, I mean, I'd already picked up on the fact that John O'Neill, who was a former deputy director of the FBI, had resigned in July 2001. And he said that he was tasked with catching bin Laden. And he said, every time I get near bin Laden, the Bush administration block me from trying to get to him and his associates arrested. And he'd given a press conference in France with Brissard and Daski, who were both former intelligence agents who were journalists, and they were all, and they'd given a press conference in July, and they'd said that in actual fact the Bush administration was blocking their investigations of the bin Laden organization. So I immediately created a little leaflet about it, which I took to the seminar. And Brissard and Daski had produced a book called Bin Laden, La Vérité Interdite, the Bin Laden, the Forbidden Truth, which is already out there in French. And therefore, there was a clear indication that something wasn't what it seemed, apart from the fact, of course, that the buildings collapsed in a completely unbelievable fashion. But of course, I waited. I didn't say anything about that at the time, because I thought I'll just wait till somebody with some technical knowledge comes forward to critique that.
Now, William Cooper, he was a US talk show host, former naval intelligence officer, worked on some of the big flagships of the US naval fleet, and then he decided to retire to a place called Eager, Arizona, and do his own FM radio station. When it became very popular, very quickly he bought a shortwave transmitter, and he was transmitting to the world. In fact, a lot of Americans were listening to him night after night, and he was running effectively his own little sort of citizens intelligence service there. Back in July of 2001, he said, keep an eye on Osama bin Laden. And the reason he said that was because CNN had done an interview with bin Laden, even though the FBI, the CIA and the intelligence service and the military were saying, we're looking for this guy. So how is it that CNN might have got access to bin Laden when the whole of the US military intelligence system, one of the biggest probably ever on the surface and the face of the planet, couldn't get hold of bin Laden, but CNN could?
Well, it's probably because bin Laden, they knew exactly where he was and what he was doing, and in fact they was allowed to do what he was doing. He was basically an agent of the CIA, although he's supposedly gone rogue. I mean, the official story is, yes, he was our agent, but when we were working together to send the Islamic International Brigades to go and fight with the Mujahideen for freedom and sovereignty in Afghanistan, but then, of course, he suddenly became a bad guy after the bombing of the US embassy in Nairobi. But, of course, if you know anything about these things, nothing is what it seems. The so-called enemies are friends, the so-called friends are enemies, and a lot of what goes on is basically manipulation of public opinion through terrorist attack. So there's no real big difference between what we saw at 9/11 and what we'd seen in Italy, for example, in the 80s with the bombing of Bologna railway station, killed 80-odd people. That was carried out by NATO intelligence services, according to Italian police investigation. And if they're going to kill 80 people in Bologna, why don't they kill 3,000 people in New York?
Now, around
quite
about the
capable
time
of doing
the 9/11 attacks, so there was the evidence and the files, the top secret files were released from a guy called Lyman, I'm not sure his first name, but Lemnitzer.
Lemnitzer, yeah.
He was trying to get President Kennedy back in the 1960s to do something called Operation Northwoods. Now, there are some strange echoes between Northwoods and what happened in 9/11, aren't there?
Yeah, well, James Bamford produced documentation about this in his book about the NSA,
the Puzzle Palace.
Yeah. We've got hold of the Freedom of Information request. We've now got hold of the Operation Northwoods documents, and it was the U.S. General Staff, headed by Lemnitzer, cooked up a plan, because the Bay of Pigs invasion had failed in Cuba. They'd not managed to topple Castro with this mercenary force, and they decided, well, what we need to do is to get the American people in favor of an invasion of Cuba. We'll carry out hijackings of planes, which will and bombings in the United States, which will be blamed on Cuba, and then we will invade Cuba as a result. And they said, we need to have a big casualty list in order to create the necessary emotional wave so that they can then invade Cuba. Lemnitzer signed off by the whole US General Staff, including Lemnitzer. It was then passed upstairs to Robert McNamara, who was consigliere for John F. Kennedy, and he immediately turned around and said, "You people are nuts. We're not going to do that. We're not going to kill our own people, blame it on the Cubans, and then invade Cuba. You're bonkers." But they were talking exactly in those terms, and we're not talking about rogue elements. The Northwoods plan had been cooked up by the entire U.S. general staff. That was in the 1960s, and of course, what happened on 9/11 was a reworked version of the Northwoods plan.
Now, if you go back to the 1960s. Lyman Lemnitzer, indeed his first name is Lyman, L-Y-M-A-N, Lyman Lemnitzer. He was a regular attendee, or at least attended a couple of Bilderberg conferences with people like Henry Kissinger, David Rockefeller, and those types. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it at the time, what was going on at the same time? The Cuban Missile Crisis, a very near nuclear war.
Indeed, and it was Kennedy. If you see the film 13 Days, which is a Hollywood film but a pretty accurate account of what went on, the US general staff were pushing at every stage for why don't we press the button and start the war. And Kennedy, to his great credit, said, no, we're not doing that. Now, look, just as he was saying, well, no, we're not going to blow up our own people to start a war with Cuba.
Let's have a look.
But of course, eventually he was removed, and others more pliable were put in.
Context. Is there anybody you think running for US president that's got the sort of gravitas that Kennedy had to stand up to the military and say no, a nuclear war is not a good idea?
Well, Trump has indicated that he's not happy with the aggressive stance of US foreign policy, but then he's such a mercurial figure that you can't rely on him to stick to that. And Hillary Clinton, frankly, is in the pocket of the military-industrial complex 100%. So it's a pretty depressing prospect.
Now, there's absolutely loads of propaganda, folks. I'm sure many people out there will be just switching off their televisions thinking, oh no, not loads more propaganda. But there is something which looks quite good. If you want to look at something on mainstream TV, it's on next Tuesday evening from 9 till 10 p.m. on ITV, and it features somebody called Jimmy Walter, who we met many years ago, didn't we?
Indeed. I mean, he was he was one of the first of the U.S. He basically used to be a businessman in the U.S., so he got some resources of his own, and he saw through it almost immediately and started funding people who were critical of the official story.
So yes, lots and lots of propaganda around, but it's quite strange, isn't it? I suppose in a way the media don't want to admit that they have been part of this terrorist deception, because actually in a way what they're doing is they're actually part of the active protection of criminals who are now walking the streets.
Well, indeed, and of course infamously the BBC reported the collapse of World Trade Center 7 20 minutes before it actually collapsed, with the Trade Center actually behind World Trade Center 7 actually behind the BBC reporter saying, oh, we've just got information that World Trade Center 7 has collapsed, and it's actually sat behind them, not collapsed at all. 20 minutes later it did collapse, which tends to suggest that the whole thing was an orchestrated takedown. And what I think is likely the case, the third plane that was on its way to hit was supposed to hit the building 7, but it had been shot down on the way, which wasn't part of the plan. And then of course they've got to get rid of the evidence by blowing up the building, whether it's been hit by a plane or not. And in any case, as architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have pointed out, there's no way that planes crashing into buildings make them collapse not just into rubble but into dust in their own footprints. It just doesn't, no physics possibly justifies that.
Do you actually admire, this is such an audacious plan, isn't it? And they managed to get away with it, pretty much.
Well, they have, but they didn't fool people like General Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on the day, and if people want to look him up, they will see that from the very beginning that US's enemies, like the Russian general staff, knew exactly what was going on.
They didn't fool Alan Zabrowski either, did they?
No, Alan Zabrowski is the former head of studies at the director of studies at the US Army War College, US colonel in Marines, served in Vietnam. He actually, to be honest, it took him a while to work out what was going on. I think the highest US military critic has been General, what's his name now? And his Major General Stubblebine. He used to be the head of intelligence during the Korean War. He explains it all on his YouTube clip. Some people knew immediately that there was something wrong, and I was one of them, because I've been following kind of bad behaviour by NATO intelligence services for many years in Italy and other places. Other people took a while before they realised something was funny about it.
So what's the significance of it all today?
well, we're still fighting a war against terror all over the world on the back of it, which is essentially bogus. I mean, we are now supplying weaponry to the al-Nusra Front, or now called whatever they're called, the Sham Front in Aleppo.
Sham Liberation.
Yeah, well, they are Al-Qaeda. They are Al-Qaeda Syria, and we are arming and training them as we have been all along, and then saying, oh, look at these terrible terrorists, we need to invade here to stop them. But we are, those terrorists are working hand in glove with their own security forces. Well, how do you stop that? I don't know. Well, decent police forces prepared to arrest the bad guys.
Well, yes, but the trouble is they get kind of, all the political police seem to be part of the cover-up, don't
well,
they?
John, so,
but
John,
ordinary police officers.
Well, John O'Neill was the most senior, was a, you know, a senior FBI
Deputy
guy.
Director of the
and
FBI.
He resigned and said, well, we're not being allowed to do our job here. And of course, I didn't realise at that time what happened to him. He got a new job, a private sector job, head of security in the World Trade Center, and then he was killed in the attack. So there you go.
So let's go back now 15 years to the 9/11 attacks themselves. And I spoke earlier this week to a guy called Manfred Petrisch. Now, he's a former investment banker in Switzerland. And he had a client who was at the World Trade Center. And he was in and out of the World Trade Center over decades, working with various clients. But let him tell the story.
My name is Manfred Petrisch, and I used to be in the investment banking area, and I worked a lot in the World Trade Center and around World Trade Center. I had a lot of customers there. I had a customer in the North Tower. I knew the World Trade Center very well, and I was, of course, very worried when this collapse happened, because I was worried about my customer in the North Tower. About 6 weeks after the 11th of September, I finally managed to contact my customer, and he told me that they all came out and survived, and that they were busy building up their new offices in New Jersey. So I asked him how he experienced that day. And he told me that when he was in the office at 8:30, he got himself his first coffee, and he was sitting at his desk, and suddenly there was a huge explosion which lifted the whole building, coming from the basement.
So how high up the building was his office?
On the 26th floor. He thought, oh, it's again like in 93, an explosion in the basement in the car park. As he got up to look what was happening, suddenly there was a smaller event which shook the building over him, which he later found out was the crash of the first plane. So I asked him, did I now understand that correctly? First there was an explosion coming from the basement, and then the first plane hit the building? And he said, yes, this is how it happened. And he doesn't understand why the media is not reporting that. So that was how I started researching and questioning the whole official narrative. And I've written now nearly 300 articles which dismount completely the official story. For me, there are a couple of reasons after 15 years that I still believe even more strongly that the official narrative is completely absurd and a lie. And the first one is that about the foreknowledge. There was foreknowledge that 9/11 will happen because of the financial transactions that happened beforehand. There were put options done, and I'm out of the financial area. That means somebody was betting on all the companies who will suffer from 9/11, like the insurance companies and the airlines. They were putting put options on those stocks, which is a bet that they will drop in value. So somebody knew it was going to happen. The so-called investigation wrote in the official 9/11 report that part of the money is of no relevance. That's what they wrote into that report, which is, of course, ridiculous, because that's the most important factor. Who financed 9/11? Who profited from 9/11? Who put these put options and bets on the stocks, etc., etc.? But they didn't go after this whole thing. They were not interested in it.
So, Martin, here we go. This is one of the first and most important parts of this 9/11 story that's unfolded over the years, or not unfolded, because a lot of the mainstream media has simply spiked these crucial stories, which is who made money out of 9/11. And we know at least one person that did is the executive director of the CIA, funnily enough, a guy called Buzzy Krongard. He managed the firm that handled these put options on United Airlines.
You'd have thought if there was Sherlock Holmes investigating this, this would be what he would call a clue as to who actually did it. But of course, what happened is that the media presented this about a week after the attack, said, oh, well, somebody bet on it, somebody must have known, and the assumption was that it must have been the Bin Laden family. But of course, it wasn't the Bin Laden family, it was Buzzy Krongard at Deutsche Bank, and that, of course, then just died the death, and everybody forgot about it. But of course, they did know, otherwise they wouldn't have put the put options on.
Very good our article up on Global Research. Research.ca, which is a 9/11 attacks criminal foreknowledge and insider trading lead directly to the CIA's highest ranks, is the headline. I'll put a link on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. Martin, between 6th and the 7th of September, Chicago Board Options Exchange saw purchases of nearly 5,000 put options on United Airlines, but only about 400 call options. So, I mean, we're talking about something like 100 times more one than the other, or 10 times more. But anyway, assuming that 4,000 of the options were, 10 times more, brought by people with advanced knowledge, these insiders would have profited by about $5 million. So that's not a clue.
Well, it's a clear indication of who knew what was going to happen. All of this stuff is there. And as I say, people like the Russian general staff will have known almost immediately what went on. Ivashov was in command of the Russian armed forces on that day. He's retired now, but he's quite clear. If people check his stuff out on the internet, he speaks English. He gives interviews in English. He said, well, pretty much from the get-go, we knew what was going on. It's the public in the West that don't know, because they've been bamboozled by a tidal wave of propaganda.
Merrill Lynch & Co., which occupied 22 floors of the World Trade Center, saw 12,000 October $45 put options bought in the four trading days before the 9/11 attacks. The previous average volume in those shares had been 252 contracts per day. In other words, a 1,200% increase. When trading resumed, Merrill's shares fell from 46.88 to 41.5. Assuming 11,000 option contracts were bought by insiders, somebody profited by about $5.5 million just from the Merrill Lynch shares.
Yeah, but as I understand it, people didn't turn up to claim the money. Because they knew that they would then implicate themselves in the situation. And I think the third plane was supposed to crash into WTC-7, but for some reason it got shot down on the way. Although, of course, the story is that the brave passengers managed to overcome the crew, although of course they supposedly talked about it on their mobile phones as they were doing it, which of course at that stage, mobile phones were not usable on planes.
Well, Conscious Mess is a Bristol blogger, and he came to see me earlier this week and handed over a whole load of brilliant vox pops he'd done in Bristol's city centre with you folks out there about Building 7, and it was quite amazing that hardly anybody had actually heard of the Building 7. Now, this is crucial evidence, Martin. How is it that some of the most key facts to do with the 9/11 attacks, people in Bristol, we like to think that we're fairly up on things, knew almost nothing about it?
It's because The media take their cue from the government, especially in times of crisis, and even if they had the inclination to look into it, they know to leave it alone. It's career suicide to question these things. And let's face it, that people were shocked, horrified, as they were supposed to be, by the appalling loss of life and all the rest of it. And at that point, any questioning of the official story is then treated as treason, etc.
So why is why is Building 7 such an important part of the sort of looking at this, undoing this, or putting together the jigsaw of what really happened?
Well, anybody who wants to can just go online and put WTC7 into a search engine, and they will see the third building collapse at 5:20 in the afternoon, several hours after the first two buildings.
But the BBC have made a film this. BBC did a conspiracy files just on Building 7.
They did, and those who are interested will have followed it, but the ordinary punters have already moved on to X Factor and the Brazilian football.
Well, they were saying effectively that this building was just that was a fire that brought it down.
Yes, well, the point is that the fire was in the other two buildings had been hit by a plane, which started a fairly substantial fire. WTC-7 hadn't been hit by a plane. I think it was supposed to be hit by the third plane, but it wasn't. And then the Larry Silverstein, who actually was the... Don't forget that the whole complex had been privatised 6 weeks before the attack, and massive insurance payouts were made to the new private owners, which included a consortium including Rupert Murdoch. But previously, of course, the whole complex had been owned by the New York Port Authority. So it was privatised, and then they took out very bizarre insurance against terrorist attacks, specifically against terrorist attacks.
Now, if you go
and
back
then suddenly,
through...
glory be, there's a terrorist attack.
If you go back through some of our old shows, you'll hear an interview I did a few years ago, not long after the attacks, actually, with British guy Scott Forbes. He was working as a technical assistant in one of the, you know, doing IT stuff, basically, for some people in the World Trade Center. And he was given a day off work that day, or a day off work in lieu, because he'd been inside the World Trade Center over the weekend, and there'd been a power down the whole weekend. So he'd had to bring all of the servers for his company down and then put them back up on the Sunday evening before work started on Monday morning. Now, what he says is during that time, he saw people going in and out of the building all the time, basically carrying bags like workmen. The power was off in the building. There was no security at all.
Yes, in actual fact, the security company that ran the World Trade Center, which had employed John O'Neill, who then died in the attack, was also one of the owners of that was Jeb Bush, the president's husband, president's brother. All of these straws are out there, and fundamentally, if people are really interested, is architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. They've got over 2,000 architects and engineers now who have come forward and said there is no way, Jose, that those buildings collapsed into their own footprint at free-fall speed unless they were bombed. I mean, bombed by, as in the sense of being rigged with explosives.
Well, I also asked Manfred Petrisch, who, by the way, blogs in German at All Smoke and Mirrors, Alice Schaut and Rausch is his blog, about the what it means today. I mean, he's originally Austrian, but he speaks very, you know, obviously he speaks very good German. He was working as an investment banker in Swiss Germany as well. And so I asked him what he thought about today's world. And also, he's one of the people who's very concerned about how close the German government quietly is to the Israeli government.
I've been telling this, the Germans, since years I've been telling them, do you know what you are? You're a target, because all these command centers which manage all the wars in Syria and everywhere, like in Stuttgart, we have AFRICOM is the headquarters there, and we have Eurocom in Wiesbaden. That means all these American bases, all these command centers. Do you know that from Ramstein, all the drones are controlled, which fly all over Pakistan and Afghanistan and Yemen and everywhere, all these killer drones, they're all controlled from Ramstein in Germany. I told the Germans, do you realize that you are a prime target and the Russians will bomb you first? They will hit you first. They will flatten you because of all the American facilities there. That's the best reason to get rid of them.
The German government has nothing to say. Merkel has nothing to say. If she goes to the toilet, she has to call first Washington for permission. That they are completely under control and under occupation. That's why I call it the American occupation zone, because they cannot tell anything. They're just executing orders. The German people are completely brainwashed. Do you know that all the media in Germany have to sign, when they sign their work contract, there is a clause in the work contract where it says you're not allowed to write negative about America and about Israel. That's what it says in the work contract. And if you don't sign that, you don't get the job as a journalist in a newspaper. They even exchange their ministerial meetings once they're in Israel, and then the Israelis come to Berlin and they do their government meetings in Berlin.
So are you saying sort of joint meetings of the cabinet? Surely not.
Yeah, cabinet meetings are exchanged once there and once on the other side. Sure, absolutely. They're like twins.
Well, that's Manfred Petrich there from the blog Alice Schau and Rausch, which is in German, but of course you can easily get internet services to do that translation for you. I mean, he's a prolific blogger. He's extremely switched on, it seems, into a lot of doing what you do sometimes, Martin, which is to help ordinary folks like us get a grip on what's going on in the big financial world, the financial system. He believes it's pretty much on the brink at the moment.
Well, he's right. Underlying all of this, people say, well, why would the government do something as evil as this? Well, it's because they have a track record of manipulating public opinion to achieve elite goals. And, they've been doing this, blowing things up and blaming it on various, chosen scapegoats for quite a long time. They've got a track record going back to the end of the Second World War.
I mean, he's saying that Merkel has to phone up Washington for permission to go to the toilet.
Well, that's a slight exaggeration, I imagine. But, I mean, there's a top German journalist whose name escapes me now, who came out the other day, he's retired now, he said, well, throughout my career, I wrote CIA-approved copy, and I got paid for it. I mean, and he said I wasn't the only
surely
one.
Surely our whole press is not controlled like that. I mean, there must be some
most of the mainstream press is directly controlled. And don't forget Germany.
It's all in London, that's
yeah,
for
well,
sure.
In Germany, Germany is still effectively an occupied country. The Americans have the capacity, if they wish, to overturn the German constitution and bring back, basically
well,
an occupation
Manfred's
regime.
Manfred's saying is there's something like 70,000 US troops in Germany.
Exactly, far more than the Bundeswehr. So if it came to a fight, they would be able to take over if they wanted to. They're able to put a lot of pressure.
Talking of which, he mentioned the drone killings there, which are really these most evil system nowadays for just killing people anywhere on the planet, it seems. You decide that you don't like somebody. And incredible revelations this week from Ryan Gallagher at The Intercept, which has been one of the main places where the Edward Snowden revelations are. Brilliant website based in Brazil, which was working very closely with The Guardian until there was some kind of falling out. They went their separate ways. The Guardian are no longer reporting this stuff. And I was absolutely gobsmacked, Martin, when this came out 3 days ago, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday, to see that not a single press outlet in the whole of the London national and international media had picked up on this leak. What they're saying effectively is you've got a whole bunch of code names and code words for various programs which are being operated through Men with Hill. You've got something called FawnSat, which is and Moonpenny. These two, what they do is they look at foreign satellites, as you might guess, with FawnSat, and they are constantly monitoring information that's going in and out of those foreign satellites. Then there's something called Overhead, and obviously decrypting it, Overhead, which is our own satellites, which we control, which are beaming down onto mobile phone masts and Wi-Fi connections all over the world, and sniffing and listening to things that are going on down there. But more disturbing is these two programs. One's called Ghost Hunter, and the other one is, I'm not quite sure what it's called, just Ghost Hunter, it seems to say here. But anyway, Ghost Hunter, which is looking at individuals, specific individuals, effectively anywhere in the world, but obviously at the moment, mostly where the drone strikes are taking place. And they're saying, right, this person, as they log onto the internet, we're keeping it everywhere in the world, we're keeping track of them. So every time they go to an internet cafe, log onto their email, immediately Ghost Hunter knows where they are.
Yeah, and of course the implication from the article is that they're actually setting people up to be assassinated by US drone strikes. And, Britain does engage in drone strikes, which are illegal, of course, because it's, you're basically zapping people without any judge, jury or executioner. You know, you're not playing by the rules of international law at all. And the British are very heavily implicated in it.
So Men with Hill, I mean, this isn't a US base. We were talking about Germany, but this is
we're talking about sovereignty earlier.
Piece of US soil in North Yorkshire.
Yeah, it is. The local Labour MP, whose name escapes me now, has been pressing for more transparency about what goes on there. But of course, they don't want to talk about it because most of what they're doing, especially setting people up for assassination and killing lots of innocent people, because of course, these drone strikes are pretty indiscriminate. You know, you can imagine dropping a bomb on an individual, all the people next to them are going to get killed even if you've got the right person.
You've also got the double tap drone strike which they're doing, where they're deliberately killing people like paramedics who come along to try and help those who are dying from the initial illegal drone strike.
Indeed. And of course, all of this is illegal in international law, so and therefore fulfills massive, the criteria of being a terrorist attack.
Massive story. Effectively, what we're being told here is that Menwith Hill is keeping us safe from criminals in other parts of the world. Actually, what it looks like with this latest revelation is that actually the real criminals are sitting behind computer screens up at Menwith Hill.
Well, that's quite right. And, of course, it's is this in the British national interest? Well, I would argue that it isn't. And maybe if we're going to leave the European Union, we ought to leave NATO and kick all these bases out and then turn around to the rest of the world, the former empire and everybody else, and say we don't do that stuff anymore. We've got a different agenda.
Ghost Wolf is the other one. I said Ghost Hunter, but Ghost Wolf. And Ghost Wolf, what that's doing is specifically looking at internet cafes. So everybody that looks, so say, for example, if they know there's an internet cafe where radical people go, then they're looking at every single person that logs in and out on that internet cafe.
Well, they can probably just track people through their mobile phones switched on or not.
But isn't it interesting that we're now getting these, you know, this is such a long time where people have been scratching their heads, what are the golf balls at Menwith Hill really all about?
Well, they've always been involved in spying. I mean, back in the day, before modern technology, IT technology, they were bugging, you know, telephone lines, and the so-called Five Eyes treaty, the echelon, where the five Western powers, New Zealand, Australia, Britain, France.
But hang on a minute, surely that would be 10 eyes if it's 5 powers.
Oh,
maybe there's only one eye at the top of their forehead.
Could be, yeah.
Maybe that's
But anyway, the CIA is not, in theory, allowed to spy on US citizens. So, of course, the British then conveniently do that from Britain for them, and vice versa, so that the British secret MI6 aren't supposed to spy on British citizens, but the CIA can spy on them because they're foreigners, and then they just swap the
now, one of the most fascinating things I've seen this week, looking at some of this 9/11 stuff, was the name Kobe Alexander popping up again in connection with the 9/11 attacks. These Israeli tech companies have also been accused of designing bits of software which can use Microsoft operating systems, etc., to get right underneath the programs, either on phones, but most importantly on computers in military systems. So they're going into a military system via the operating system, and nobody actually can even see where it's happening. That is, for example, you've got a firewall or something. This thing is going underneath that radar too, and it's making things appear on your screen, appear in programs from a remote location.
Well, if you were dealing with a serious military opposition like Hezbollah in Lebanon, for example, who are very technically proficient, or even somebody like FARC in Colombia, they know very well not to use any electronic communications whatsoever, because it's all vulnerable. And of course, that is just a fact. So in other words, all of this spying doesn't get to, I mean, Al-Qaeda, of course, is not vulnerable because they're actually being run by the Western intelligence services, so they can presumably use as much electronic equipment as they like because they're watching them anyway because they want them to do what they want them to do. But let's talk about the real opposition, like Hezbollah. They know that they're under constant observation using electronic means, and they have their own countermeasures, as you would.
Well, yes, as I said at the top of the hour, Kobe Alexander was a name that popped up. He was the founder of this company, Odigo, and I was just listening to a talk by Christopher Bolin. Now, Chris, I met as a photographer back at in Jeanval in Belgium near Brussels, the Bilderberg conference. He was photographing Kissinger, Rockefeller, various other people who were there at this meeting. Bilderberg conferences were founded in 1954 and chaired for the first 20 years by former SS officer Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, until there was a scandal from him. And these people really, Martin, do seem to be the sort of people who are effectively kingmakers right across the NATO countries.
Well, that's right. And as I say, 9/11 didn't come out of a blue sky. Bologna Railway Station was bombed in 1980 by NATO intelligence services. That's what the Italian police believe, and the Italian courts. They've carried out assassinations and bombings for many, many years, and mostly not in the US, mostly in allied countries.
So we heard about the foreknowledge earlier, about the put options. What about the foreknowledge of people that got little messages on their pagers and this kind of thing? Back in 9/11, on just days before or even hours before the attacks. Here's Chris Bolin talking about it, and we'll discuss it afterwards.
Their end game is a large-scale ongoing conflict between Europe and the West and the United States against Islam. These are people from the Israeli military who came to the United States, and they had a company in New York called Odigo. And Odigo was a instant messaging software that would send messages out to large groups of people that weren't necessarily friends, but you could choose, for example, parameters like, say, I want to send this message to everybody who identifies as an Israeli, and I want to send the message in Hebrew, and I want to send it. And so that way they had a program called Buddy Finder, and it's like a derivation of Facebook, and it would send out this message to everybody who was Israeli and everybody who spoke Hebrew. And the message was probably in Hebrew. And this Kobe Alexander, he created this program, this company with Comverse and Odigo, and this is what was used on September 11th. This program was used to warn people not to go to work that day at the World Trade Center.
And that was very, very definitely sent. You can confirm that?
Oh yeah, it was reported. It was the FBI sent people over to Israel to verify and find out who had actually sent this message. Because the company in Israel, several employees of Odigo that were Israel-based, reported getting this message. So the FBI sent some people over there, and the message, the actual contents of the message was never revealed to the American people, and the actual investigation never went much further than that. But the vice president of the company, Alex Diamandis, he confirmed to the media that the message had been precise. As to the attack at the World Trade Center, and that it was precise to the minute.
Wow. So this is a glaring piece of evidence of foreknowledge.
Yes, and you see, the thing was is that this fits hand in glove with another fact of 9/11, and that is that the Israeli Foreign Ministry reported that there were 4,000 Israeli nationals, Israeli citizens, who were expected to have been in the area of the World Trade Center or the Pentagon on 9/11, and their families had contacted the Foreign Ministry in Israel, you know, asking for any information about the whereabouts of their loved one. And the thing is that of this 4,000 people who were expected to have been in the areas that were affected, only four people actually were killed, and four Israelis were actually killed. So Israelis, survived with very few casualties on 9/11. And, you know, this message that went out several hours before on Odigo appears to have been the device by which these people, their lives were saved.
Well, I mean, this is all evidence, isn't it, piling up? I mean, have you seen the Conspiracy Files programs? They said, and the conspiracy theorists, they say that the Jews had a warning and they didn't turn out to work. Well, it's not just the Jews, it's specific people, and there's a specific mechanism by which they were warned. There were other mechanisms. I mean, Warren Buffett was supposed to be there that day, and so were a lot of other top financial people, but as it happened, they were all at Warren Buffett's birthday party in the Offutt Air Base in Nebraska. So they weren't in their offices that day, because they were all at this breakfast party at the Offutt Air Base in Nebraska, which just happens to be the same air base that George Bush turned up later in the day on Air Force One on, and all of these top oligarchs just happened to be at the air base with Warren Buffett. That was handy for them, wasn't it, because they were all supposed to be in their offices in the World Trade Center, but just that morning they weren't there because they were all on this, and you can see how you'd deal with that. You just say, make sure you're at the birthday party. You don't have to tell people what's going to happen, just say, look, just make sure you're the birthday party. And of course they all were waiting for the arrival of the President of the United States.
Now, if you're going to start getting out of the reinvestigate 9/11 mode and into the who actually was behind it, because obviously you can't prosecute anybody if you don't know who did it, Chris Bolin's book Solving 9/11 really does begin to do that. It's a whole series of articles that he's written over the years about various bits of evidence about who did do the September the 11th attacks. But then there's that quite supposedly controversial article which the Reverend Stephen Sizer in London was told by the Archbishop, actually no, it wasn't Canterbury, it was the Bishop of Guildford, I think, said that you're going to be suspended if you speak about the Holy Land at all, in fact, he said, and you're not allowed to use any messaging services or Facebook or Twitter or anything like that, Stephen Sizer. But then that was because he'd done a link to an article which you can find on Wikispooks and various other places, and that's 9/11, Israel did it, all the proof in the world. Now, is there really proof that Israel was involved?
I think there is. I mean, there's the five dancing Israelis who were they when the first plane hit the first World Trade Center tower. Somebody saw a local watched what was happening from their window, and they saw people standing on top of a white van. Five blokes standing on top of a white van, and when the, and they got a video camera. And when the first plane hit the tower, they all clapped and cheered and did high fives. She gave the number plate of the van to the police. 8 hours later, the van was stopped, and the five guys who were actually cheering the attack turned out to be Israelis, all Mossad agents. They were held interviewed by the authorities in the US and eventually released. They went back to Israel and they went on television in Israel and said, yes, we were filming the event and we did work for Mossad, but all we were doing was just documenting the event. Documenting a surprise attack, which nobody knew was going to happen, but they knew exactly to be in the right place at the right time with a video camera to film the first plane hitting the
building. Chris has done a whole load of research into that, Martin, which takes that even further. What I'll do is I'll put a link up on our webpage, thisweek.org.uk, to that interview we just heard a clip from, which is Chris Bolin interview, 15th anniversary 9/11 special, and that's put up on YouTube by Lone Ranger. I'm not quite sure who he is. I actually names himself somewhere in there, I'm sure. But anyway, let's just take stock of 9/11 today, Martin. There is a lot of propaganda going out. It looks like the media are not giving up with their version of events at all, doesn't it?
Well, they can't really, if you think about it. Once you've dug yourself into a corner and you said, well, this is what we're going to talk about and this is what it's all about, and we all know this is what happened, you can imagine if you were to question Hillary Clinton about it, she'd have an absolute freak out and say, how dare you question all of this, blah, 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 you're a traitor, whatever. But I would argue that asking the serious questions about what goes on is not treason at all. It's actually patriotism, and the people who are trying to cover it up, they're the traitors.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, the road to Damascus. There was certainly some talks about that, thinking about it this week, as something called the Friends of Syria held a big conference here in London, all about how the Assad regime is going to be toppled and why it needs to be toppled, etc. So it doesn't seem like, even though it looks like Assad is possibly going to be beating a lot of these with the help of the Russians, these so-called opposition, who many people call terrorists, what do you call them?
Well, it doesn't really matter what we call them. They have no popular support inside Syria.
I mean, an opposition.
I think that's the reality.
I mean, an opposition.
They have some, but not much.
An opposition is, you usually use that word to refer to, say, somebody like Ed Miliband or else possibly Jeremy Corbyn, not necessarily to a bunch of people with guns.
No. And the double standards and the hypocrisy around all of this is absolutely appalling. So we you know, it's okay for the Syrians, the Saudis to invade Yemen and Bahrain and kill any number of people. That's okay. But the Syrian government attempting to control its own territory to prevent mostly foreign fighters from killing its police officers and soldiers, they're in the wrong. I'm not suggesting that anybody's entirely above reproach here, but the whole thing stinks.
So, the Friends of Syria, one of their spokespeople is the MP Brooks Newmark. He is really talking about WMDs, basically saying that the Syrian government is constantly using weapons of mass destruction, mostly chemical weapons, against its own people, and therefore something must be done now to remove Assad.
Ever since we had that famous red line back in 2013 with respect to the use of chemical weapons, Assad changed his strategy from using what was defined as a chemical weapon to using what are effectively chlorine bombs. And chlorine, unfortunately, under the definition of a chemical weapon, doesn't fit within that. So we've seen several incidents since 2013, and particularly recently in Aleppo, the use of these chlorine bombs, and anybody who goes on, you know, social media in particular, will see the effect this has on people who have chlorine dropped on them, which is terrible. But I mean, Assad is an extraordinary person. I mean, this is a guy who is doing everything possible to try and protect his family and his family's interests at the cost of his own people. There have been 400,000 plus innocent civilians killed since the start of the war 5 years ago. 96% of those 400,000 civilians have been killed by Bashar Assad. He is the biggest terrorist today in the Middle East. People worry about IS. IS have done terrible things, but actually, the statistics are IS have killed less than 1% of civilians in Syria. The biggest terrorist today in the Middle East is Bashar Assad, and we must do all we can to stop him.
Well, that's just basically straightforward lies. I don't think anybody would accept that as a reasonable account of what's happened.
I mean, we're hearing this night after night. What do you lies?
But also the other point is...
Who is it that's doing this? These chemical attacks?
Well, you know,
who is killing their own people, just like Saddam Hussein did?
What is very interesting about this is nobody refers, and they ought to be referring, to the articles by Seymour Hersh in the London Review of Books, and he's a very serious investigative journalist, and his evidence, which he's collected because he's got very, very good connections in the intelligence services, is that the sarin that was used in the Ghouta chemical weapons attack, which killed lots of civilians, was actually carried out by the al-Nusra Front with the cooperation of the MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, and that the sarin had been sent from Libya with the full authority of the US government. So not only did Assad not carry out the Ghouta chemical weapons attack, we did. And also Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, made it quite clear on French TV a few years ago, before the 9/11.
But he's not talking about that. He's talking about chemical attacks going on now. Loads of civilians being killed.
Well, what is happening now is that they are now doing a reprise of what they did at Ghouta, which is the rebels are using chemical weapons and then claiming that the regime has used them because they want to trigger an intervention.
What evidence have you got that that's actually the rebels?
Because the evidence comes from the original chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, which was not carried out by Assad, but was carried out by NATO intelligence services, by MIT, and it was actually one of the articles Seymour Hersh has written, says that Hillary Clinton knew that the sarin was from Libya and that she signed it off. Now, if we're going to start accusing people of killing people, who can seriously believe that Assad has killed more than 99% of the civilians killed in this war? I think that's just wrong. It's just unbelievable, like everything else they
say. Well, one of the other things that Brooks Newmark says, that actually there's a sinister thing going on here. Putin is really Assad's puppet master.
Assad has now Putin as his master. Putin is becoming the master puppeteer, not just in the Ukraine, as we've seen, but now in Syria. Putin himself has been accused of dropping phosphorus bombs and deliberately targeting hospitals in and around Aleppo. But nobody seems to be holding either of these characters, Assad or Putin, to account. And I believe they must be held to account.
By whom?
Well, by the world community. I think the difficulty is doing that through the UN, because the UN itself, with the rules and the Security Council, prevents that. The irony is that with Russia as one of the five members, it makes it very difficult. So we need to find alternative ways around it. And I think one of the things we should now be thinking about, otherwise I'm afraid you and I in a year's time will be having another conversation with another 100,000 plus people dead, is having a strategy of keeping the skies clear over Syria. Unless we do that, Assad and Putin will continue dropping bombs, chlorine bombs, phosphorus bombs, barrel bombs on innocent civilians. We did that in the Balkans, we may well have to do that again. Otherwise, we will just stand by, wring our hands, and see the massacre continue. And I know, there is no good choices here. There has never been good choices. But, as we've seen, following the 2013 debate and vote, that sometimes doing nothing is not always the best option.
We were right not to intervene in 2013 because, as I said before, the chemical weapons attack, according to Seymour Hersh and other serious people, was carried out by NATO, not by Assad.
And
of course, if we're going to try and have a no-fly zone over Syria, then the Russian Air Force are going to shoot our planes down. Good. That's what will have to happen.
Also, it was actually also Carlo Del Ponte at the United Nations who was pointing the finger at the rebels in Syria as the source of the sarin gas attack in Ghouta. You're quite right, Martin. But moving on, who actually no, Boris. Does he go along with the Friends of Syria and Brooks Newmark, Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary?
I think Boris will probably be taking a very cautious approach. I think obviously the focus at the moment with the Foreign Secretary, with the Prime Minister, are issues closer to home with the implementing Brexit. And I think, I suspect we will see, and John Kerry has given 110% in his negotiations with Lavrov to try and at least get some humanitarian aid into Syria, particularly to Aleppo, where the people today, I think there's 300,000-ish people left there, are being starved to death. You know, allowing in humanitarian aid must be a priority. In order to do that, they have to stop barrel bombing and dropping chlorine bombs. Now, I'm hoping there will be steps towards that, but at this stage, while both Assad and Putin think that they can win this war, which they can't do, and while they think that they can win it, they will not negotiate seriously. The only way individuals negotiate seriously are if they think they can't win.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid we're in another situation like Lebanon, where you and I will be having this discussion next year and the year after, because at this stage, I just can't see a way forward unless we stop the aerial campaign of dropping chlorine bombs and barrel bombs on the people of Syria.
So this Tory MP is calling for war with Russia. Let's be absolutely clear what he's calling for. He wants the RAF...
No, Martin, he's saying we've got to stop the use of chemical weapons by Assad, isn't he?
Yes, and the way he's saying we're going to do that is by having a no-fly zone over Syria. Now, what that means is you are going to go to war with Russia. The Russians won't accept that. We wouldn't accept it if people tried to impose it on us. There's no basis in international law for it. Not least, of course, because the things that they're claiming are wrong, and they themselves have carried out these attacks, as has been made clear by the journalists in Turkey, who uncovered the fact that this was going on, have been prosecuted by Erdogan. And the truth is exactly precisely opposite what this gentleman is asserting.
Well, his name's Brooks Newmark. He was on Five Live earlier this week.
Well, indeed. Well, he's
Peter Allen. So let's hear the final clip now, where he explains who the Friends of Syria really are. That's his group.
So the Friends of Syria are basically a coalition of ordinary Syrians, a wide range of people representing not just the Sunni community, but the Christian community, the Shia community, the Alawi community, a broad coalition, the Friends of Syria represent, plus the international community, to have a strategy, because this is what probably most your listeners will be want, is the importance of dialogue is important, and that maybe jaw is better than war. I take a different view of it. I take a more robust view that unless we clear the air of these planes that are causing the mayhem on the ground, the other party actually won't engage serious negotiations. And I think both Putin and Lavrov have pursued a strategy of keeping the West talking while they continue to bomb the people of Syria.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you feel that we perhaps missed the trick before when we refused to get involved. I mean,
yes, I think 2013 we had that opportunity. I think we would have accelerated the process of sitting down to a serious negotiation. Now, at the end of the day, I suspect Putin will deliver on getting rid of Assad. The question is, how much blood has to be spilt between now and then?
Well, here we have the British politician saying what should and shouldn't happen in Syria. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, made it absolutely clear several years ago that he was approached by the British to start an armed uprising in Syria. The SAS and other British special forces have been inside Syria working with Al-Qaeda, the Al-Nusra Front, the people we're supposedly fighting because of 9/11 after 15 years. This is absolutely disgusting. And don't forget that the original chemical weapons attack he's talking about, all the evidence suggests that was NATO who carried out that attack,
so Martin,
not Assad at all.
So, Martin, is the BBC's Peter Allen right when he says maybe we missed a trick in 2013?
The whole narrative is a war narrative. It's war propaganda and of lies of the most disgusting kind. The Tory MP who's coming out with it probably doesn't even know what he's talking about, but plenty of people do. And I'm afraid that the Russians aren't going to back down. And if he wants to have an air war with Syria, let's have it. Let's see who wins.
Now,
it'll be the Russians,
somebody
I think.
Called Zbigniew Brzezinski has admitted, apparently, that the Turkey coup was carried out by US national security officials. He said this, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page. This is an article by William Engdahl, and in a tweet, he admitted that the Americans were involved in the Turkey coup attempt.
Yes, I wonder if that Tory MP knows that, or cares, or has anything to say other than repeat the lies of the Pentagon.
Also, Israel has struck back at the Syrian army after mortar fire hit the Golan Heights. Didn't kill anybody, but the Israelis seem to think the Golan Heights is theirs, and if any mortar fire hits it, they're going to hit the Syrian Arab army as a result.
Yes, and various senior figures in Israel have said we don't want to see ISIS defeated because it's very helpful in bringing down Assad, which is also what the NSA report said, which was leaked by General Flynn a long time ago. What's actually happening now is you've got US special forces fighting with the Kurds who are against ISIS, and ISIS being supported by the CIA.
And finally,
unbelievable.
The Israeli army are deploying autonomous vehicles to kill people on the Gaza border. So that's where we are, folks. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up for the next 2 hours, Arabian Nights and Mohammed Bakawi. Dialect is back, more on 9/11 and other things. Columbia on Tuesday at noon. I'm on thisweek.org.